This was, watching Blue Planet 2 was perhaps the first time in ages I've thought, oh my God, what a time to be alive. Mm. Unironically, no sarcasm. Because I was just thinking, you know, 50 years ago, nobody got to see this kind of thing. I mean, 10 years ago, nobody got to see most of what we're seeing in this series. And it made me feel just so fortunate. And then it made me very excited about, what are we gonna see 10 years from now, 30 years from now?
When was the last time you were out and about and something caught your attention, completely knocked you out of your mundane frame of mind and made you think, well, fuck me? Can you remember? My guess is whatever it was that knocked you out of sync was somehow grand. Maybe in size, maybe in complexity, maybe in the depth of time or emotion of it all, but huge. The last time I felt this way was 2 nights ago. I was walking home from seeing a movie with a friend, and the crescent moon over Glendale, California, where I live, was just enormous. It completely changed the perspective of the world for me. So there I was, walking through the low, Mediterranean-inspired, kind of kitschy buildings on Brand Boulevard, and suddenly a celestial object I'm used to seeing as the size of a dinner plate was bigger than most of the buildings around me. I was quite literally awestruck. One of my best friends, the recently hooded Dr. Russell Cohen-Hoffing, he and I do these science-inspired meditation hikes. If you live in LA, I'll invite you to the next one. We also do science and comedy variety shows. We do a lot of cool stuff. Anyway, at these hikes, we like to talk about awe and its vital role in the human experience. I lead the group through some yoga and a guided meditation, and then Russell knocks it all home with a brief lecture. I wanted to read an academic quote he pulled from his last lecture about how psychologists define awe. So, Dr. Lonnie Shioda says, "Awe is an emotional response to physically or conceptually extraordinary stimuli that challenge our normal day-to-day frame of reference and are not already integrated into our understanding of the world." Why is it important to feel engulfed in something huge, to have our frame of reference challenged? The anthropologist Barbara J. King, who I've spoken about on the podcast before, she writes about the evolution of the human religious imagination. She states, and I am for sure paraphrasing because I don't take good notes when I read books, she says that this religious imagination came about because of a couple different human traits, but mainly these two. One is a need for what she calls belongingness, so that's belonging to part of a group or a social species after all. And the other is how we co-create meaning with those around us. That, coupled with our amazing imaginations, we began to expand that from just within humans to that that's outside of ourselves. So these grand experiences, these awe-inspired experiences, could be read as an experience of belongingness. Engulfed in something so much bigger than ourselves, we feel small, yes, but also that we belong, that we're part of something. And with that huge something, we can co-create meaning, and thereby make our lives more meaningful. Anyway, I'm rambling, and I am very, very tired. I'm sorry that this is a day late. My laptop died, and I had to get a new machine. Hopefully, the sound on this is all right. I've heard from a bunch of you that these have been too quiet, and hopefully they'll now be loud enough that you can listen to this in the gym. Hey, everybody, welcome back to At Least There's This, a podcast about some of the small silver linings in our world of hurt. As I've been saying a lot in my intros, I don't know where you guys are temporally. You could be listening to this right when it comes out, which means that Donald Trump is still our president and everybody feels like the world is falling apart. You could be listening to this in 100 years when the world actually fell apart and you're trying to arm like an uprising against the robot overlords, and this is the Bible you've chosen to make your thing, which, by the way, I appreciate that. Regardless, wherever you are in time, shit is rough. You can feel like maybe you're swamped underneath an ocean of troubles. But in a world where you've got an ocean of troubles, at least there's
Blue Planet 2.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm with Sandra Sorensen, journalist, comedy writer, also formerly of Cracked, and we're going to talk about Blue Planet 2. Do you want to intro yourself to the audience really quick, just in case they don't know your work?
Of course. So I am formerly of Cracked. I was one of the editors at the Personal Experiences section, which was kind of this cool hybrid of the Cracked format and journalism. And so while I was there, I was an editor, and I wrote a bunch of articles, and I scripted a bunch of videos, I narrated a video, I did some voiceover work, I did some podcasts, that kind of thing, and it was a blast.
I can hear your voiceover work coming loud in my pants. It's good.
It's my NPR voice, you know. And now I am... Is this where I say where I?
You can say whatever you want. We'll do plugs at the end, but if you want to plug now, that's cool too.
Either way, now I tweet at Ladyfriend. You can find my work portfolio style at sandrasorensen.com. And I'm about to leave LA for the foreseeable future in about 2 weeks.
Yeah, I heard. I heard. I got connected to Sandra through a probably former guest. His episode will probably come out before hers. Randall, and he's saying you're going to or back to Portland?
Back to Portland.
Okay, yeah. Cool.
Yeah, I have just a bunch of projects I'm working on, a podcast I can't yet say too much about, and I just felt the pull back up north. So
Yeah.
And I thought I'd clear up this spot because I'm not a huge fan of sunshine, and I feel bad taking, you know, someone else's spot in LA when they might actually get something from the sun. So
you guys, in case you can't tell from her voice, Sandra is a vampire.
Yeah, I have basically cave dweller complexion.
Yeah. And so, you know, we're not going to mention that too much, but we are going to talk about the ocean, a deep, dark place, which is great for vampires and those who hate the sun. Before we talk about that, I like to start my episodes asking my guests whether or not they're optimists, pessimists, anywhere on that scale, because I find it's a good sort of entrance into, even though it's kind of a forced metric, it's a good entrance into the way that people think.
Absolutely.
Do you know, could you speak as to where you might be in that continuum?
Yeah, I definitely think I'm an optimist. It's gotten back to me that people find me upbeat. I don't know if it's coming across today. It's a nice thing to hear about yourself, I guess, a nice rumor to have get back to you. I do think I'm an optimist, and I kind of feel like that's at odds with how much I struggle with anxiety.
Mm.
So I feel sort of existentially that I'm an optimist, and sort of globally and on behalf of the other people and humanity, I'm definitely an optimist. But in sort of the day-to-day minutiae of life and sort of more looking inward, that it can be more of a struggle. But I definitely feel some buoyancy that keeps me going.
I get that, especially with the constant anxiety. Is anxiety a thing that you struggle with? So you struggle with it day-to-day, or does it burst out occasionally?
I mean, I think there's always just that nice little subtle flavor of it, and it can be very situational, for sure. Rob Delaney, the comedian, had a really great thing to say about, to paraphrase him, I think he said that he found pessimism arrogant, and his rationale, I'll tell it very quickly, but he'd had this really horrible experience where he got blackout drunk, crashed his car, full body cast, goes to the hospital. Well, first he's arrested, then he goes to the hospital, and he comes out with incredible medical debt, and he goes into a billing office and he says, you know, let's figure out a payment plan. And he's newly sober, and they're like, oh, don't worry about it. These nuns, there's a convent in like middle America somewhere, like Oklahoma. These nuns took care of it. Like, that's their cause. I don't know if he was put in some lottery, and they're like, cool, him, we're taking care of his debt. And so Delaney's point with all of that was, you know, how could I have ever imagined that that was what was going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
And when you have the choice between fearing disaster and doom and not, maybe just don't fear disaster and doom. So that's kind of how I try and come at it with optimism.
Yeah. So it's almost more of a guideline philosophy than something that you feel the anxiety, it sounds like, in the background. But you try to move towards the pole star of optimism.
That's such a great way to put it.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Have you always been that way, like through childhood or?
Yeah. And you know, it's funny. I was thinking about that the other day. I had a good, nice, positive upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like maybe what happened was that, you know, maybe anxiety is just sort of innate to some people, because I think I started coming up with things to be anxious about because I had a really solid family life. And then when I was about 7, for example, I'd start becoming convinced our house was going to burn down. Or
yeah.
And so I don't know. I think it's just maybe something that I have to just confront. And but I think the current administration isn't helping.
No. It's good reason to be anxious.
Yeah.
There's this philosopher I like who I've mentioned before on the podcast. I hate saying his name because even though he's English, he's got a Swiss name, and so you have to put on an accent to say it. But Alain de Botton. And
oh, I love him.
Yeah, I love him too. I fucking hate it. Your name is wonderful. It just makes me sound really pretentious when I say it. And I read his articles pretty frequently online, and one of his more recent ones was like about why we need something to worry about.
Oh,
and like how human and necessary that is for us to always have something to be like gnawing on.
Right.
Like I've heard the anxiety sort of complex likened to a dog just like needing a thing to chew on.
Yeah.
And I think there's something adult about it when you're like, well, fuck, now I need something to worry about. It's like, well, welcome to adulthood, 7-year-old Sandra.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think it's pretty common with people who struggle with anxiety too. You have this belief that you're constantly fighting, that you can buffer yourself from catastrophe or all the bad stuff by constantly worrying about it, because at least it won't take you by surprise.
Right.
And that's, I would like to say that's just not true. I mean, and that's something I've been working on personally, is just trying to let that go.
Yeah. Are you, if you don't mind me asking, are you like doing stuff like professionally for that, or?
Not so much professionally, but I've been led to a lot of just really cool self-guided meditation.
Cool.
There's this cool, this is going to sound so new agey, but there's this cool thing called tapping.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I have friends who tap.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to say, if, say, you wake up really anxious or something, and you, there's some really good guided tapping videos on YouTube, totally free, obviously. And that will always help me.
What I sort of feel from tapping, there isn't really like an ontology to it, right? There's no metaphysic. It's just, it's a thing you do to remind yourself you're present, right?
Well, the claim, I haven't read too much up on it, but yeah, they, I think they think of it as like emotional trigger points. So
right.
I can't really speak to it either way.
But if it's working for you, yeah. I mean, there, I feel this way about a lot of maybe therapies or like sort of new agey or self-guided therapies that like, maybe the reason they're saying it's working isn't why it's working, but it's working. So why do we need to be judgmental about why it's working? If it's helping you, like it's helping you, so good.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's forcing you to take time out of your day and challenge your negative thoughts, which is, I think, the best thing you can do.
That's the, yeah, and just be present with your negative thoughts too. Like, oh, fuck, here I am.
Exactly.
Why do I have to be here? Yeah.
And be okay with that discomfort, which I've heard can be really healing. But I'm not often very present with my discomfort, so I don't know.
Which I believe, if I'm ever there, could be great.
I'll check back in and let you guys know if yeah, I ever decide to go that route. Yeah.
I'm healed. So how does that take you to Blue Planet, specifically to?
Right.
And do you want to actually, why did you choose 2 as opposed to 1, the whole series?
Right. Okay, so Blue Planet 2 just came out last year, and I think it was just distributed in the U.S. At the beginning of the year.
It's on Netflix, right?
I don't think it's on Netflix.
Okay.
It might be on Dailymotion, maybe.
I think I've
It's on Amazon.
I think I've seen it.
Right.
Because I dig, it's Attenborough, right?
It is Sir David Attenborough.
God, I love Attenborough.
I love him so much. That's probably a big part of this. He's so calming.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons is just, I'm going to overuse this term so much, but it's so mind-blowing. And Blue Planet 2 versus Blue Planet 1, we just have such better filming technology. So as you're looking at this footage, and they go, you know, every episode has a different theme, but you're largely underwater. And you're looking at this footage, and what's actually happening is, you know, they'll have, for example, the technology so that divers who are filming, they have suits that keep them from emitting bubbles or making any noise.
Whoa.
So they can stay present. So let's say they're just a few feet or however far away from dolphins as the dolphins are feeding underwater. The divers as filmers can just hang out for so much longer. And then the footage that you end up with is much less obstructed than if you yourself are the diver, because I mean, I don't know how much that costs to get that suit, but you're not seeing bubbles. They have, there's certain shots where they surface out of the water, and you'll see, for example, an iceberg with a mama walrus and her baby on it. And there's no, as you're looking at the screen, there's no receding water line. And I don't know how they did that.
Wow.
But it's just, it's so beautiful. It's kind of ultra real.
Yeah.
That's what it's like to watch
it. That's amazing. That's such a good phrase, ultra real.
Yeah.
So there's something I feel about these nature documentaries that is, because you're on one hand, you're not experiencing nature. I'm using air quotes, which you guys can't see, because you're sitting at home, which, I mean, you can make a philosophical argument that you're still in nature because people built it and people are animals. But you're also experiencing a thing that you could never experience otherwise.
Exactly. A great example of that is, I think one of the more popular episodes, I think they just call it The Deep, and it's incredible because they have these two submersible vehicles, and they go down 1,000 meters, which I think is something like 0.6 miles. Anyone?
1,000 meters is like 300 or 3,000 something feet, which is nearly a mile.
Yeah, and so they do this in the waters of Antarctica. They also do it in the Mariana Trench, but no one has ever gone that far down in a manned vehicle in the waters of Antarctica. Uh-huh. And it is incredible because they go down into what's called the Twilight Zone, which is, I forget exactly how far down that is. I have it in my notes, but they say 90% of ocean life lives there. And there's a little bit of light, but it's pretty shadowy. Mm-hmm. And they go down to I think they go down into the midnight zone where there's absolutely no light and the pressure would kill any one of us. So, I mean, me personally, you can barely get me on an elevator. You couldn't get me into a submersible. And also, I don't have those connections.
Right,
you know? No one's
going
to invite me to do it. What was also fascinating and kind of scary is that they're about a half hour down and saltwater, seawater starts coming in because they didn't know how this vehicle was going to react to the water. And I had this thought, like, did they bring cyanide caplets with them? Because there's a good chance this could go wrong. And then they have to resurface and there are these humongous icebergs above them. And so they have to be incredibly careful because everything's, you know, moving and coming together and dropping rocks. And it's just, so you're right. I think very few of us will ever have that experience firsthand or want that experience firsthand. And so they gave that to us. And I think watching Blue Planet 2 is going to sound sort of stoner, but I felt so much gratitude for that.
That's beautiful. And I don't think that's stoner. What you're reminding me of right now is like images from astronauts.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's similar in that, like, I'm not an astronaut. Yeah. I am not going to ever experience what an astronaut experiences, but I'm never begrudging that I'm looking at it through a camera.
Right.
And it does totally change your perspective to see this thing, right? To see the Earth from underneath the oceans, which I've been in a submarine once, right? And it made me seasick. So to see everything from underneath the ocean, it's so perspective changing.
It really is. And I keep coming back to that idea about gratitude because I just think this was watching Blue Planet 2 was perhaps the first time in ages I've thought, oh my God, what a time to be alive. Unironically, no sarcasm. Because I was just thinking, you know, 50 years ago, nobody got to see this kind of thing. I mean, 10 years ago, nobody got to see most of what we're seeing in this series. And it made me feel just so fortunate. And then it made me very excited about what are we going to see 10 years from now, 30 years from now?
That you're so right. I have not thought that in a long time.
I think it's interesting, too, because it's sort of the flip side of our fear that we have of this dystopian future where as we're developing all kinds of different technologies, we're also crafting the instruments of our own doom, you know, with AI and everything, Android, Cylons.
I mean, Cylons are hot, though, so I'm not worried about that.
Hey, there are some androids where, you know, I wouldn't say no.
I wouldn't kick them out of bed for making computer crumbs.
Exactly. Chips. Leaving chips in bed.
Yeah, nice,
sorry, that
nicely
was...
done. No, no, you won. You won with that.
So again, looking on the bright side and being optimistic, I think, a lot of this technology, this theoretical technology we're thinking of can be wielded for evil and maybe it'll increase inequality, but also look at how we can use it in these beautiful ways to document our own world. And because, you know, I chose Blue Planet 2 also rather than Planet Earth or whatever, which is also great, but it's because the oceans are so unexplored.
Yeah.
Right. And they say we know more about Mars than our own ocean, so that's a huge deal.
Yeah, I think whenever people like are talking about astrobiology, a lot of times they look at the oceans because it's the most akin to an alien world that humans can get. Because it's nothing like what we deal with up here.
No, exactly. And there's, I can't remember the name for it, but when they're talking about volcanic activity in, you know, the depths of the ocean, mm-hmm. because they say, here's another fun, I'm just spouting facts from the documentary.
I fucking love fun facts, so don't stop.
Okay, so 3/4 of volcanic activity that happens in the world happens in the deep sea. And hypothermal vents. So hypothermal vents are kind of like, I guess they're basically underwater volcanoes, and they're teeming with life alongside them and around them. And some scientists believe that life may have begun within or around those kinds of vents about 4 billion years ago. But to tie it back to space exploration, we've discovered deep seas on the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. And so what the researchers for Blue Planet 2 have said is, you know, we have things in our deep seas that are, there's life in every part of our ocean, places that we would not expect anything could survive. Mm-hmm. So that gives us every reason to believe that there's probably lots of life. Deep seas, yeah, on the moons of Jupiter
right.
and Saturn.
It's Europa, right? Europa and Titan are the ones that have, it might just be, it's one of those two.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I'm going to go along with
it. Okay, great.
So I just learned this from a 6 or 7 hour series. I mean, my God.
Right? There's something really special about a wonderful documentary. Yeah. I'd love to talk about that forever because I love the Blue Planets and Planet Earth and Cosmos is like one of the most effective things in my life, the Sagan Cosmos. But I want to, instead of talking about that, I want to talk about gratitude. Because you've said gratitude several times.
Yeah.
And that is really an operative word for, I think, this whole podcast and the point of this. So watching this makes you feel grateful for being alive.
Yeah.
And how does that work for you in your day-to-day?
Definitely the idea of perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not just gratitude at knowing that these things are out there. In a very basic way, it's gratitude at knowing there's so much mystery out there.
That's cool. I like that a lot.
It's a great feeling.
Yeah.
I love that. I love the idea that I'm never going to know everything about my own planet.
Yeah.
Because that would get so tedious.
Right. It would be like living on the moon where it's just rock.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, this
well,
again.
Then what? Yeah. Okay. Oh, more? Cool.
Yeah, exactly. So I have a lot of gratitude I don't know if you want to call that spiritual or just sort of.
I'm happy to call that spiritual.
Yeah.
I don't think spiritual has to do with metaphysics necessarily.
Right. So gratitude for that, and a very basic gratitude for the fact that the BBC put this together over 4 years and then the production crew often got into some very dangerous situations, but also were incredibly patient to get all these shots. So
it's amazing.
Yeah. So I can actually point gratitude toward certain people and, but also, you know, gratitude that I'm, again, what a time to be alive and
right.
that I have access to this. It's footage. I'm not even seeing it firsthand, but
yeah.
I really feel like I have.
It's amazing because you couldn't any other time and it, does it make you feel like you're part of something?
I guess it does make me feel like I'm part of something. I mean, I've been in the ocean. I've been to sea camp.
Really? When did you go to sea camp?
When I was 7.
That's right when you started feeling anxiety.
Oh, no. I'm sure I felt it before then.
Okay.
It was amazing. It was a week long. It was in Marina del Rey. And it was every day was obviously something different, but one really cool thing we got to do was there's this these mud flats that I think were kind of like an inlet, and they were government owned, and so whoever was running the camp had to get special permission. And so we just waded around in these mud flats and like pulled creatures out. We had little baskets and put them in the wading
pool.
That's
so
and
cool.
Yeah, we had these amazing instructors. The last day we went sailing.
Oh, that's so great.
It was amazing.
Yeah. Now I think I found more of what I'm looking for, and that's not a oneness necessarily, but a curiosity.
Yeah.
It sounds like this inspires, and maybe the sea in general, although we were talking earlier and we're both not sea folk, but that it inspires and engenders a lot of curiosity in you.
It does. I wouldn't say I'm not sea folk. Okay. A seafaring person. I've gone sailing sometimes.
Okay.
But
you're basically an expert.
I am. The sea is my mistress. No. But it's not. It's true. It's not a big part of my life. But yeah, it does inspire so much curiosity. And I think every episode of this documentary, I mean, I think it's just stated fact that there's something that's never been at least documented on cameras, either a creature or animal behavior.
Yeah.
And I love that. It's like, give me more. Give me more of that.
Right. What else can I learn? What else don't I know? Or what other questions can you inspire me to be curious about?
Exactly.
Which is, I think that that is a spiritual value.
Yes.
Like curiosity and engendering further curiosity. And it sounds like this documentary is doing that for you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, just seeing creatures I never knew existed, both humongous and small, hearing how old certain creatures are. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I love that.
I love that too. Like the Greenland shark or whatever, the one that's like 400 years old.
Oh, I didn't know about that.
Yeah, there's like sharks in Greenland that just survive for 400 years and they're fine. They're ugly as hell. They're really ugly.
Idea.
And they don't die.
There is one thing that's very creepy looking and very Tim Burton-esque is this thing called a bobbit. It's a carnivorous worm, and
ew.
It lives in the sand, and it has these teeth that, or it's sort of like the, what is that thing in Star Wars, the Sarlacc?
Oh, yeah, the Sarlacc pit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's sort of like just right there.
Uh-huh.
And it covers itself in sand, and it'll just like jump up when a fish passes by. But its ancestry, I mean, it's not 400 million years old, but its ancestry, they think, is about 400
so
million years old.
So it's been the same thing for 400 million
yeah,
years.
Yeah, and boy, it looks like it.
Ooh, you need a makeover.
Yeah.
We're talking about Bobbit.
Yeah.
Get your shit together.
Exactly. Let's
oh,
do
they
too.
Call it the Bobbit because it looks like a penis, right? Because of the whole, like, Lorraine and whatever Bobbit thing from back in the 90s?
Yeah, I don't know if it's been called that only for the last 20 years.
I think they discovered
so they moved,
it.
Oh, did they?
They discovered
it. Is that
it,
true?
Like, right around when that was happening. And so some cheeky scientist named it the Bobbit.
Well, it can grow to be a meter long, so that's a bit of a tribute.
Ooh, doggy, yeah. She had to cut a lot, is what you didn't know.
Yeah.
It was a big... big hunk of flesh.
Yeah. With teeth, though.
Yeah,
so
with
you
a lot
get
of
it.
Teeth.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, she was in the right because,
yeah.
Ouch. the adaptive value of some of those things is so awe-inspiring and comforting.
Yes.
It's like, well, that thing has survived by just constantly changing. I think I'll be all right.
Yeah, I'll be okay
yeah.
as I, you know, go through some life transition or switch from one job to another or move out of state. I
right.
guess I can do it.
I'll survive somehow.
Yeah,
yeah,
you're absolutely right. It is very comforting. And I mean, just and that feeling of, I mean, this is going to sound like such a childish thought, but I remember
those
thinking,
are the best thoughts when you're talking about gratitude.
Yeah. So I remember thinking, oh my God, this has been going on for so much longer than I've been alive. You know,
yeah.
when you see these behaviors.
Right.
And just, you know, checking in with my ego and saying, just because I just found out about it doesn't mean this hasn't been going on for thousands to millions of years
yeah.
and will outlive me. And I kind of appreciate that too.
It's so much, it's about scale, I feel like. It's grandiosity, but not necessarily visual or physical. It's just deep, deep, deep time.
It really is.
Yeah.
And actually in the ocean, in the episode about the deep, they talk about how time kind of does work very differently there. There's coral in the great depths that often grow off of fallen rock that's come from icebergs. And some of those coral, I believe they said, can be as much as 4,000 years old.
Sheesh.
Yeah.
That's so cool.
It is so cool.
It just keeps going. I think that really knocks me off of my, like, ego's feet.
Yeah.
Whenever I see something that old, because, God, do I feel like, I feel like a gnat. I feel like I live and die in a day.
Right. I feel exactly the same. But going back to optimism and gratitude, I know for a lot of people that might remind them of their mortality, but it doesn't make me feel less important or less significant.
That's cool.
It just is. Yeah. And that's super cool.
Anything that can engender a like sense of acceptance about life and death, I think is a really special thing to have.
I think you're absolutely right. And that's something that that I've come across in reading about, you know, self-guided meditation and just ways of self-soothing is to not assign value, to be neutral about certain things.
Well, there is, I mean, you said in the beginning that you have a really hard time just being present with your anxiety, but it sounds like through this, you're very present with like, well, the Bobbit's been around for 4 million years and, you know, I'm not going to be around that long, but it sounds like you're chill with it in this case.
I'm chill with it, especially because I'm reasonably certain I will never come across a Bobbit. if that was a possibility, I think I'd have a very different emotional reaction to that.
You'd have a very different outlook on life. You would not be an optimist.
No. Oh my God, I'd never leave the house.
Life is hell because this thing is just here.
Yeah.
This penis-looking sandworm.
I mean, that is, you know what? I'm grateful that doesn't keep me up at night.
Yeah, you're right. That you have a very healthy mentality to not be afraid of that all the time. So, okay, we've talked both about kind of the big and small G a little bit, but I think I want to talk about the big more because we've kind of straddled the two about this, how it's very comforting and awe-inspiring and kind of knocks you off of maybe thinking about yourself so much. But I do want to talk about why the fact that this exists, you think, makes the world a place worth being alive in.
I mean, I think I mentioned this earlier. It definitely makes me stop thinking so much about the current administration. I think it's the power of distraction and the power of just feeling pulled into something. If I can go off on a bit of a tangent.
Please do.
One weird thing I do that I know a couple other people who do this too is if I'm going through either personal or political turmoil and I want a distraction I can't watch an action movie. I can't watch a rom-com. That won't get me. I have to watch a supernatural horror film.
Ooh.
Because if I'm scared, I'm paying attention. I have no choice.
Yeah.
So there's this fear. But it's a very controlled fear. And maybe it's partly kind of cathartic, you know. So I have no choice but to follow the story. And being someone who appreciates good storytelling, being a storyteller myself, I think that the possibilities that are presented in, you know, a good version, you know, the better horror films out there, that's what gets me too. The questions that arise. I don't necessarily believe in ghosts. I've never seen one. I just think that that power of mystery is something that really appeals to me. And in an often very, you know, fictional setting. So it's safe to indulge in.
Yeah.
I don't think that I'm disrespecting anyone's actual memory. It's not like I'm watching a true crime documentary. Not that by watching one you are disrespecting someone's memory. But you know what I mean. It's sort of indulging in mystery and kind of thought experiments that are very low stakes. But in the moment, they're scary. So actually, after the election, a friend of mine, my friend Sarah and I, started going to see just any supernatural horror flick that was playing because we both found out that we were doing that, you know, just as an escape and just as a break from the news.
Right. Yeah. So I feel like life, current life, is so mysterious because, like, at any – well, are we going to die in a nuclear holocaust tomorrow?
Right.
And this sounds like you said, a much more structured mystery. And taking it back to Blue Planet 2, every episode is about a structured mystery, amongst many other things, but it's, like, mysterious about what's up with this worm.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's going on with these polar bears? Let's find out. And like, you didn't know this. And there's a mystery to it that feels way safer than the mystery of like, well, are we going to find out that the president's a dictator tomorrow?
Yeah. That's absolutely true. And it's almost, I don't want to downplay the danger that we are in right now politically at all.
Everybody who's listening knows and is aware, and they know that you know, so it's okay to downplay.
We've covered my anxiety. But it is, you know, I guess, you know, that term, what is it, John Oliver's term, stupid Watergate? There's also this aspect beyond the fear and the uncertainty and the anxiety with Trump. It's just like, I resent so much what an idiot he is.
Yeah.
So it's fun to indulge in mysteries that have much more beauty and timelessness. Like, so for example, I remember there's one episode with this octopus who's very performative in front of the camera. It's like she knows it's there. Mm-hmm. And they film her for months and months. And then one day she gets, well, I don't want to give away the ending, but
I'm sure everybody who you're not going to spoil it. Don't worry.
You guys, this is just so cool, and you can break this out at parties. So she gets attacked by a pajama shark.
What?
Did you even know that that was a shark?
No. Are they really comfy?
I think they're comfy inside themselves because they're way smaller than great whites, but way more aggressive.
Really?
Yeah. And so this octopus looks like a goner. The shark has her, and she stuffs her tentacles in his gills, and drives, I know for sure she's a she.
Right.
I should say, in the shark's gills. Could have been a lady shark. Who knows?
Sure.
The shark swims off, and then the octopus goes to the ocean floor, and with her tentacles draws in all these shells around her, so she's sort of like creating armor. And the shark comes back, and it's cartoonish because it can smell her. She or he can smell her, but can't find this octopus. And then the shark just swims away.
That's so fucking cool.
Isn't that cool?
That's so awesome.
And it was so great for the two divers who were filming, because they'd filmed her for so long and they were rooting for her and they were attached and they didn't know that an octopus could do this. So again, that just gives me faith.
Stuffing its tentacles in the gills feels like an anime move. Like, this is the last attack I have.
Yes.
This better work. And it, like, works. And then she sinks down and takes on a new form with this shell armor. Oh, fuck, that's exciting.
It belongs in anime.
Yeah,
it's not
absolutely
already.
Does. That's so cool.
Yeah.
And you don't know what's going to happen. And there's something beautiful about it.
Yeah.
Rather than, like, the ugliness of, does our president shit his bed every night?
Exactly. Is the first lady dead? I mean, that's something everybody's wondering right now.
Yeah, man, that is not a beautiful mystery at all.
No, no. They're all horrific and stupid mysteries. And you know what? They're but a blip, you know, in the chronology of the world.
Of the world, it is but a blip. It'll pass. Maybe in the history of humans, it's the end times, but the world will go on.
Yeah, a lot of these creatures are still going to be doing their thing. That octopus is going to be okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. The only people who won't be okay is us.
Yeah. Oh, God.
I love the idea of stupid mystery versus beautiful mystery.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that we all crave from the beginning of art.
It
seems like from Greek tragedy on up, it's trying to create beautiful mystery versus, like, the stupid mystery of, like, fuck, my husband slipped and he broke his leg and now he's got sepsis and he's dying.
Right.
And instead, like, no, there are gods and I don't know what's going on and this is beautiful.
Right. Exactly.
So we've covered my big, and I think we've covered the little,
because
it's like calming and it helps with anxiety. And there's that Attenborough voice. If anybody doesn't, well, I can't do one. I'm bad at accents.
I lived in England for a year and I never could do a convincing accent.
It's hard because you sound like you're trying. Can you do a good David Attenborough?
I can't do a good David Attenborough, but I can do my voice.
That's good.
Yeah,
it's
engineer Jake is actually British, but he's not David Attenborough.
I think out of the three of us, you would be the front runner to narrate our undersea documentary.
Undersea documentary. Is he as loved in England as he is here?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Is he a knight?
Yeah. Him and his brother both were.
Yeah. And his brother's an actor, right?
Yeah, the late Sir Richard Attenborough, which was actually my introduction to David, because I loved Sir Richard Attenborough first because I was obsessed with Jurassic Park.
Oh, right. I always
so
conflate the two because he's basically playing his own brother in that movie, right?
Yeah, his own brother with just a god complex.
Right. His own brother, but evil.
Evil, yeah. I mean, a well-intentioned, but really unchecked kind of character.
Yeah, which is why the BBC only lets David Attenborough do so many documentaries.
It's true.
Because otherwise, he'll create dinosaurs.
I know. Ow, that's a great idea. They just keep giving him series. It's like, we're going to go bankrupt, but we got to do this for the world.
We got to do dinosaurs. That's what's next. Oh, God, that's wonderful. Yeah, his voice is really terrific, although he's getting up there. I heard an interview with him on NPR just after Blue Planet 2 came out, and you can even hear it in Blue Planet 2 that he's starting to, like, slur
right.
a little bit, which is... It makes me grateful that he got to finish some of, like, his life's work, because he's been doing all of these documentaries for years. This has been his life.
Right. And that was another thought that I had when I was watching this for the first time was, I know that he's familiar with the material, but how does he record this narration without stepping back from the camera and going, holy shit.
Holy fuck.
What? Really?
Look where we are.
I know. look at what that octopus can do.
Yeah, he's got to be at once both very jaded and also just very awestruck by everything.
Right.
So, jaded so that he can get through his job, but awestruck that he keeps doing it.
Right. I mean, I think you can compartmentalize.
Yeah.
Like, I used to – this might be a weird comparison, but I used to be a newspaper reporter, and I would do court coverage sometimes, and I would be in professional mode, and I covered a couple of murder trials, and, you know, I'd find them upsetting – but I'd be fine in court, and then I'd drive home, and I'd have a tension headache, like, immediately. So I think it's just sometimes you can compartmentalize for your job and then later be struck by whatever emotional resonance, you know, your assignment was.
No wonder you need a six-hour documentary series about the ocean.
To forget what I've seen in court.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, Crack gave me a nice break from that. Crack never made me do court coverage.
They never made you have to deal with in-person murderers?
No. No, that was nice. No parole hearings, nothing like that. So,
right.
Yeah. Actually, I have something else I wanted to bring up, and I hope it's not too much of a stretch.
No, I love big stretches, because then we have to knit it back together, and that's where the fun comes in.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so I want to make sure that I'm not getting my terminology wrong. But, so I have a friend, a good friend of mine, who was... His parents are creationists, and he very much is not. And I watched a couple episodes of Blue Planet 2 with him, and he and I actually walked to the south part of the south rim of the Grand Canyon a few months ago.
That's so cool. Yeah.
It is so cool. And if there's one very easy path that's paved. I don't know if you've been there, but they have rocks on the side, and they have plaques that say how many millions of years old that particular rock is, and in some cases, it's more than a billion years old. And I've had this conversation with this friend of mine a couple times because, you know, obviously in creationism, you believe the world is fewer than 10,000 years old. It's something like 6 or 7.
Yeah.
What's so strange to me is that I had a very different upbringing where my parents were very progressive, and it wasn't necessarily a religious household, but it was a household where religion was accessible if I wanted it. So, you know, they kind of gave me the rundown of our family's history, which most recently was sort of Methodist or Lutheran. And I remember once my mother ran this idea by me, and I've stuck to it ever since. She's like, well, you know, when you look at the Genesis story of creation, you don't have to think that every day of creation was a 24-hour day, which is, of course, if you're a creationist, that is how you see it.
Yeah.
You know, a day could be figurative. It could be eons, you know. And I love that idea. And so she and I talked about, and I remember being very young, and she and I talked about how, you know, these two ideas, you know, the Genesis and science and evolution do not have to, that they can peacefully coexist. They can kind of complement each other.
Yeah.
So I was talking to a friend of mine the other day who just happens to have a master's from Harvard Divinity School. And I said, hey, is that terribly naive of me if I were to bring that up in the say context of Blue Planet 2.
Yeah.
I'm like, is this just a naive story or idea? And she's like, no. That's, I think it's called theistic evolution. So I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but it's just the idea that yes, these two things can peacefully coexist. So the way that that relates back and the thing I kept saying to my friends watching Blue Planet 2 was, I guess I don't understand if your focus is on God and you believe that there was a creator, how is a 6,000-year-old world better than something that's billions of years old?
Yeah.
And I said, you know, because I would think that, you know, I'd much prefer, you know, my religious views are sort of in flux, but I would much prefer, if I'm going to believe in a creator, that I think of someone who took their time and was extremely detail-oriented.
Right.
And with the, I think, theistic evolution, there's a couple schools of thought. And one is that, you know, God – sort of got the ball rolling, and then the world became this sort of lovely petri dish or petri dish.
Y'all take it from here.
Yeah, you guys do what you're going to do. And then there's another school of thought within that that says that God was involved every step of the way with evolution. So every adjustment and telling the Bobbit would stay the way it was. That could be a children's book, actually.
You're good, Bobbit. You're fine.
You don't worry about it.
No, humans, take five. Get your shit together. Yeah. Bobbit, I love what you're doing. Looking like a long-ass penis with teeth. You keep being you.
Human shoulders back. Head up.
Yeah,
come on.
Head up. Come on. Up. Up, up, up.
So anyway, and my friend, the child of creationist, agreed with me that, you know, why deny yourself this easily proven truth, scientific fact that the world is beautiful and complicated and extremely old, and there's so many wonderful things happening that we'll never know about.
Yeah, I think it is, and you've clearly shown that you love being pushed off of your ego. But I think it's an egotistic, protection mechanism. No, the world was made for me. It's 6,000 years old, and it was set exactly like it is. It won't change. I am where I'm supposed to be, and nothing – like, there's no way where anything could be different. So I don't need to be stressed that, everything's inconsequential or whatever. I know it's all about me.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, which is – I mean, I think – I can't speak for Engineer Jake, but I think the two of us probably are not of that mindset.
Right.
Where I love thinking, God, I don't matter. I'm so inconsequential. I think that makes the world more beautiful.
For sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that's often a comforting thought. You know, it's a pep talk people can give each other. It's like nobody's thinking about you or looking at you as much as you're thinking about yourself.
Yeah.
Like, so if you're in a group, like weightlifting class or something, uh-huh. or jazzercise, which I've heard has made a comeback. I mean, just go for it. Nobody's looking at you. We're all worried about ourselves.
No one gives a fuck what you are doing. I think that young Earth creationists have a lot of anxiety, and it's a relatively new school of thought.
It really is. It's very new because my friend Margot, the scholar, pointed out that, you know, a lot of our great scientists from a couple centuries ago, they came from the church or a very religious system.
Yeah.
And it wasn't seen as at odds.
Newton was very religious.
Exactly.
Galileo, I think, was part of the church before they burned him.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, sorry, buddy. But I think it's only 100 years old. I read somewhere that as science sort of came on the up and up, and it had this idea of truth. Oh well, this is fact. We proved this. Then sort of the church came back with the young Earth creationism. This is truth, right?
Yeah.
So we have this written down. So this is truth, and then it sort of became inflexible. And there's a lot of anxiety. I think it comes from anxiety.
I think you're absolutely right. And I can imagine that if I didn't, for example, if I didn't find comfort in this idea of, you know, being somewhat insignificant in the scheme of things, and if I didn't find comfort in how old everything is, and I wanted more certainty in that way, I can absolutely see why or how I might adopt that belief system.
Yeah. No, I totally can, too. It's sort of like flat earthers.
Right.
No, this is about me, and I want to be important, and what I can see is more important. It's,
right.
Right. It matters to
Even
me.
Even though there's a horizon.
Right.
Whatever. It's cool.
go up in a plane. It's just a lie. I just can't see it.
Yeah.
But I think it's more comforting. At least you definitely have let me know. You find it comforting for there to be mystery, for you not to know what happened past the time of recorded history or what's going to happen in the future. We
right.
don't know. And there's something that can either produce a lot of anxiety or it just gets so fraught with the ups and downs of what do I know that you just kind of chill out.
Yeah. Well, and I also think for me, mystery in its way kind of is synonymous with possibility.
Ooh. Ooh. Oh, that's a pool quote. Oh, that's my pool quote.
Thank you. I could say it faster. I know I kind of...
No, that was really good. I mean, I kind of talked right before you, so I might not have a good enough one, but right.
Do you want me to say it again?
No, I'm letting my audience know right now, if I didn't use this as my pool quote, I wanted to, and it's my fault for being a bad editor.
But I guess, again, it might sound kind of counterintuitive because in times of uncertainty, more uncertainty, I do find it incredibly, anything is possible.
Right. And that's even true with all the stress we're in. It's just we're worried we're all going to die. But if you are able to step back and say, like, well, where will I be in 40 years? It could be pretty cool once all the bad shit happens.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, there's an ebb and flow. I think it'll get better.
Yeah.
Do you think it'll get better?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm an optimist in a way, but I can't. I guess what does better mean? You know, what do we know?
Yeah.
It'll keep going.
Right.
That's all I can say. But I think something will happen, and to the right person, that something will be amazing. And it just might not be me. I hope it's me.
Yeah.
I hope I'm around to experience something really cool. But
me too.
Yeah.
Well, I think at the very least, you'll be around to experience Blue Planet 3.
God, I hope.
Oh, my God.
Who's going to do it, though?
You know, I have faith. I don't – maybe – Sir Attenborough will pull through.
Pull through and do some of it, or at least do like an intro and an outro.
Well, so here's another way that I can apply my optimism in my life. So one of the things I get kind of neurotic about is, I don't know if other people do this, but I think about what sort of genetic issues might be in my family and might someday fell me, you know.
I know the ones that are in my family already.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And so the way that I comfort myself about that is that I just think life is short, but it's in its way kind of long. And also with technology, by the time that X disease would become an issue for me or someone I'm very close with in my family, you know, maybe we have the technology and we can rebuild him or her or me.
We can rebuild Sir David Attenborough.
Exactly.
We can make him better.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it'll just come at just the right point where he's just, you know, leaps out of bed like the grandpa from Willy Wonka and finds his feet and he's just a young man again. And
fuck it, 10 more blue planets.
Exactly.
I'm never going to die.
And the BBC is like, oh my God, we can't afford it.
We can't afford this shit. Like, I'll make the money myself.
There's so many like murder procedurals we're gonna have to cut.
Yeah,
it's gonna be so ugly.
Well, there goes Luther season 10.
Yeah, is Broadchurch still on?
I don't know. Is Broadchurch still on?
I don't know.
Okay. Well, this has been really edifying. This has been a really good conversation.
I really enjoyed it.
So did I. Is there anything I didn't touch on that I should have touched on? Any questions I didn't ask?
No, I mean, I do want to make it clear that I have not been a lifelong nature documentary fan.
Thank you for making that clear, because I think people thought you were and they would have been disappointed.
Well, yeah, I think that speaks very well to Blue Planet 2. It just came along at just the right time for me personally.
Mm-hmm. Why was it just the right time? Please make it all about you.
Oh.
I'm interviewing you.
Well, not to get too much into it, but I'd actually been away from home for a couple of months and I was going through a time of really intense transition. And so I came home and I was just kind of settling in and kind of going through the transition. I don't want to bore anyone, but it was a really great time to just, again, sit down and be distracted. And had it come out, you know, a year ago, I don't know that I would have been in the same place where I'm like, just awe me, just blow my mind.
Yeah.
I would have meant to watch it and just not.
I can relate to that so much.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I meant to watch that thing. I never got around to it.
Yeah.
If you want to make a quick elevator pitch for Blue Planet 2,
right
to, let's say you've got some family out there listening, or I've got a listener who listened to my episode about metal because they love heavy metal, and they're like, oh, fuck this. What would you say to them to get them to watch Blue Planet 2?
I think I'm going to repackage a lot of what I said. It is a clear view of some incredibly harrowing areas of the planet that you will never otherwise get to see, and you'll be so happy that you've had that exposure.
Hell yeah. Okay. Well, can you give us plugs now so people can find you and find stuff you do?
Absolutely. So I have SandraSorensen.com. That's my portfolio. I'm on Twitter at LadyFriend, all one word, obviously, Twitter. And everything else I'm working on is a little bit in the early stages, so there's nothing I can really point anyone toward, but there should be a podcast in the works pretty soon.
When that comes out, we will publish it on our Facebook page, and I'll tweet about it too.
Thank you so much.
Of course, yeah, friend of the pod.
Yeah.
Friend of the pod means friend of the pod for life, unless you fucking spite me.
Are there tattoos like they did with Lord of the Rings, or like at least a temporary tattoo?
We can definitely do temporary tattoos.
Cool.
Everybody, thanks for listening. I super appreciate it. As always, if you liked this episode or any other, please share it with a friend. This is all done through word of mouth, so I don't pay for advertisement because I can't figure that shit out. Share it with somebody. If you happen to hate this episode, share it with somebody who you don't like. If you could give it 5 stars on iTunes, that would be great. Maybe you're sitting down to watch Blue Planet 2 because it sounds really good, and you're about to roll up a real tight doobie, a real tight jazz cigarette to make the viewing that much better. Well, while you're doing that, give your phone to a friend, ask them to give this podcast 5 stars, and then sit back, relax, and let the soothing sounds of the ocean and Sir David Attenborough take you to another world. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. You can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and I guess Instagram, although that's now kind of defunct, at least pod for all three. And I'll talk to you guys next time. Bye.